Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Hello there, you're very welcome along to Golf Weekly. If you're listening as usual on the podcast, if you're watching on YouTube, or indeed if you're listening on this Sunday afternoon, it's very nice to have you with us. We have Fionn Davenport in his abode in Manchester. Hello, Fionn.
Hey, lads.
And we have former European Tour player, Rookie of the Year in his day, everybody, Peter Laurie. Hello.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
I saw somebody tweeted to say they had driven by the driving range and that the grass was looking in excellent shape.
Yes, we're trying to do a good bit to it. We're getting a putting green up and running. We're getting all the short game area should be ready to go, hopefully, when we come out of lockdown. And our outside bays, people love hitting off grass. So we're going to have them in top-class condition. So hopefully we'll be ready. Maybe touch wood next week, but who knows?
Excellent. We will have Stephanie Meadow calling into the podcast this afternoon. She's over in Phoenix, and like all of us, life is on hold at the moment a little bit. The LPGA Tour hoping to resume sometime around July. So great to have Stephanie back on the podcast. That is on the way. Fionn, can I start with a nice story?
Please. Please do.
Well, Adam Scott, as we know, one of the gents of the game. And there was a lovely story in the Sydney Morning Herald on Tuesday. The headline was, "No cameras, no trophies, but Adam Scott just won the lockdown's Act of Kindness Award." So there's a man called Ross Campbell, who has reportedly 7 brain tumors and experiences confusion, including a belief that he and Adam Scott regularly played rounds of golf together, that they were golfing buddies. He's 76 years of age now, and his daughter reached out to Scott. And so Scott decided to give Ross a ring and have a chat to him. Campbell's wife, Pam, stood nearby in tears as the pair spoke, said the Sydney Morning Herald. They talked a lot about golf, and Ross mentioned that he gets very wobbly in the legs when he goes out to play. He's in a wheelchair, can hardly stand up. But Adam must have sensed this and said he gets wobbly legs too.
Oh.
Adam Scott sent him a putting video that he could watch as well. So Ross Campbell had a chat with his golfing buddy, Adam Scott. I thought that was a nice story.
That was amazing. That's really nice. But I'm not surprised, given that, never having met the man, but I am 100% convinced that Adam Scott's one of the nice guys of golf. So that is a nice, certainly nicer than, well, here in the UK, the big one was Captain Tom Moore, 100 today. Have you been following this?
Yeah, I have actually, yeah.
No, go on. I haven't as well as I feel I should be. I've seen tweets alluding to Captain Tom Moore, but I haven't followed.
Captain Tom Moore, now Colonel Tom Moore, he's an honorary colonel. He decided a few weeks ago that he was going to walk, like he was 99. He's going to walk in front of his house, do like 100 lengths of his house and raise money for the NHS. So he thought he'd raise 10 grand. He's raised 30 million.
Oh.
Like it's taken over. And anyway, so he's an amazing man and he's very funny. He was asked this morning, so how does it feel to be 100? And he goes, "Oh, I'm not really sure how I'm meant to feel. I've never been 100 before." So, you know, but then of course, in typical fashion, you have this situation where like, rather than kind of just focus just a little bit on a very nice story, like BBC Breakfast did an hour on Tom Murphy, an hour. Like the whole, like they devoted from 8 to 9 PM and poor old Captain Tom, who's 100, and it's not that warm here, is sitting outside his house with his daughter, but he's like wrapped in a blanket, and you get the feeling, like, I can't read his mind, but you get the feeling he's like, okay, can we all just go inside now, please? I'm done. I suppose it's typical. I mean, at a time of great crisis that, you know, the country needs something positive to rally around, and the cynics might say is to mask the overall failures of the administration to address this crisis in the timely fashion that perhaps its critics feel it should have. So Tom Moore becomes kind of a rallying point for all positive thoughts. So that's been the big news. It's you can't get away from it here. It's all day long. Captain Tom Moore, 100 years old.
A few things going on in the world of golf. I mean, in the main, not much. That is the overriding point. Padraig Harrington continues to do numerous interviews across the week, and he's the golfer I see the most now. So he's talking, Peter, about the latest in the Ryder Cup, that potentially players might take one for the team and play behind closed doors this year as opposed to postpone. Again, we'll see what happens. And then he did say, I can tell you there is no scenario where I get 12 picks. So they've certainly ruled out the captains getting all 12 picks. Well, the players wouldn't want that either, would they, all 12 picks?
No, I don't think so. I think they'd have to look at world rankings, and then they'd have to look at the order of merit up to now, or when we stopped a couple of weeks ago. So they'd probably take it from there and move on. Because Europe, there's going to be no golf in Europe probably till middle, end of September, maybe, at best. While America will probably start back up in June. So the Americans are going to have, if it goes ahead, a huge advantage because they're going to be match fit and they're going to be playing golf quite a bit.
Two quick things I wanted to ask you about which have caught my eye this week. I didn't get to see this, but I know Rory McIlroy and Nick Doherty and Brandel Chamblee, I'd say lots of people listening to the podcast have watched it. They rewatched the 2019 Players Championship, which Rory won. You remember Jim Furyk was in the mix as well. Yeah. And I didn't see this, but I saw maybe about 10 minutes of it. It was quite interesting and revealing, and Rory seemed to be in good form. And there's always those moments as well where, you know, he hits a stunning shot to a pin which is tight on the left and next to water, and you think, wow, his swing is on. You know, he is just in complete control of things. And then the reality is Rory says, yeah, I didn't mean to go at the pin there. I just tugged that one left and got a bit lucky, you know. And of course, the commentary team and all of us, I suspect, that week were saying his swing was feeling really good that week. It just looked great, you know. So the truth between reality and perception. But the Chamblee made an interesting point afterwards on his own podcast. I want to put this to you and maybe tease this out a bit. So Chamblee's point is often that players don't work things out for themselves, that they're too reliant on coaches, that they don't deal with what's happening on a given day on the course. And the week of that 2019 Players Championship, Rory in practice and in the build-up and at the start of that week, he and I presume, I don't know if the coach was there. The coach's name again, Michael
Bannon.
Bannon, yeah, of course. I don't know if he was there or not, but certainly Rory and or Michael Bannon had identified that he was coming down too steeply on the ball in his transition from the backswing. It was too steep. And Chamblee's point was that a lot of golfers in that instance would have tried to find the remedy. They would have looked for a cure. They would have seen it on camera. They would have tried to fix it maybe in advance of the tournament starting or even on a Thursday or Friday. Whereas he was impressed because Rory decided to just accept that and play with it. And almost in a sense, in so much as you can, to use it to his advantage, i.e. the left side of the golf course was effectively taken out. And he stood up there on the 18th, which is water all down the left, and he knew he wouldn't be able to find that water with his steep swing. And Chamblee was saying this was another aspect of Rory's game, which he really admired, thought it was a good thing. And I thought we could tease that out a little bit, because I know as an amateur, if I was slicing the ball, I might try and fix that even during a round, as opposed to accept it, play with it, use it, and just try and post the best score and not be worried about deficiencies in my technique for a given day. Yeah. What does the pro tend to do? Chamblee gave me the impression lots of pros would be hard at work right through to Wednesday night and Thursday morning looking for a technical fix, as opposed to almost embracing the deficiency of a given week.
I would have said a lot of the pros would rely heavily on a coach, and they would be probably screaming at the coach on a Tuesday come Wednesday going, you know, what the hell am I doing wrong here? How am I going to get it in play? How am I going to do this? You know, what can I do to fix it? Whilst probably 25% or maybe only 20% of guys will play with what they have and actually just think about the score. And if, as you have mentioned there, a lot of amateurs will go out on a Saturday and Sunday morning and hit their first tee shot with a snap hook or a big slice and try and fix it on the next hole, rather than having the intelligence or the belief in themselves to say, right, this is what we're going to have today. I have to stand up and play for what's going to come out and try and get the ball in the hole with the fewest amount of shots. I'll tell you a very good story. And I remember playing with JP Fitzgerald, who caddied for Rory, as we all know. And JP was a very good golfer in his own right. And I played with him in the Carlo Scratch Cup. This is many moons ago. And JP had on his bag the People's Champion. JP believed in himself. which was wonderful. But he played around Carlo, and no joke, he never got the ball airborne. Right, he had a low hook coming out on every tee shot that he hit. But the guy got it around in level par. And it's probably one of the best level pars I've ever seen. And the reason I'm telling you that story is because JP had the belief in himself to, right, this is what I have today. This is what I have to play with. And I'm going to play with that. Our amateurs out there, if they could just learn to say, right, I hit it with a slice. I'm going to slice it no matter what. There's no point in working on it now. I'll leave that to the driving range or the practice fairway. Aim up that left-hand side, take the left-hand side out of play, and it's going to come back to the right. And they're going to shoot much better scores. Our 7-time winner of the Order of Merit, or 8-time, Colin Montgomery, never knew how to spell draw. Mm. All he did was fade it. He hit a fade every tee shot. So much so, he struggled around Valderrama because of the trees. They encroached the tee box so much. And that was one of the golf courses he struggled around. He tied in the playoff with a Bernard Langer. So he was that good, he still managed to get it around that golf course. But every time he stood on the tee, he hit it left to right. And he knew it was left to right. And that's the way he played the game. So there's a lot in what Brandon Chamblee would say is working with what you have rather than trying to make something better at the wrong time.
There's also, Jack Nicklaus said himself, he would show up at a tournament, he would start his warm-ups and practice, and you would see what he had that day. So if it was predominantly a fade, he'd work a fade for the round. If it was predominantly a draw, he'd work a draw for the round. And he wasn't in the business of fixing a swing during a tournament or just ahead of the beginning of a tournament. And as Peter said, like he would wait until he was away from competition play and work with a coach. Like Jack Nicklaus in all his years never had a coach anywhere near a tournament, ever. Not once. So it's an interesting one. So, you know, the one or second best golfer of all time, depending on how you see it. If he played a bit of potluck golf and go, we'll see what happens. If he could work with what he had, I don't see how the likes of you and I, Joe, we can do the exact same thing. Although it's harder to work with a horrific slice or a horrible duck hook than it is with a nice controlled fade or a nice power draw.
Mm. That's why I used the word slice very deliberately there. You know, I'm talking about the realities of a horrible slice, and you start around and you got a horrible slice. Maybe you just have to accept that and boomerang the ball 20 or 30 yards left and watch it come back.
I heard, I was watching in this endless rewatch of old golf tournaments. They were talking about Peter Thompson in one of the Opens that he won way back when in the 50s, and that he hit a kind of a ratty tee shot that had him up against a fence, I think it was a Portrush in wherever it was when it was played there the first time. And that he hit a shot where he aimed OB, and whoever was telling the story was going, it took a phenomenal amount of courage to aim OB knowing that you were going to slice the ball back around. And so it is, I think, that if you're going to play with, I know for myself that sometimes, not so much anymore, but for a few years, my bad shot was always this horrible slice. Now it's more of a hook. But like to have that confidence to go, this is what I'm playing with today, and to aim whatever it is, 30 yards left of target and trust that it was going to slice back around, I think takes, all manner of courage.
It's a very mature mindset. Peter, what was your approach on tour?
Trying to get the ball around is in the least amount of shots. I never really worried too much about the swing, to be honest with you, until probably latter in my career when I stupidly got into the modern fundamentals of the game of golf, which I probably would have been better off, as I've probably said before, stupidity is not a bad thing. Sometimes when you don't know where it should be, it's just more of a feeling. And I was that kind of a feel player. You know, if it felt right, everything was great. If it felt bad, then I had to try and recover that feeling rather than positions. But you get a lot of guys out there who are very position orientated in their golf swing. And, you know, Faldo was probably one of the start, you know, to look at positions in his golf swing. And then it's fed on from there. But probably the greatest players out there are more the feel type players, you know, Rory McIlroy, Tiger. You know, Tiger has had so many different swings, let's put us swing coaches and different types of swing. In the end, it was more feel that got him around the golf course than actual positions.
Did you see, lads, speaking of Tiger, that CBS, because in the absence of anything else to write about, they have ranked his 23 seasons as a PGA professional. And of course, like, you know, Tiger's always going to draw clicks. Got me looking at the article. But just in case...
The article you're scoffing at that you clicked into straight away.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I am nothing but an abject hypocrite. So can you guess which is number one? It's not that hard.
2000.
Yes. 2000. 9 wins, 20 events, and 3 majors. It's just... and but here's an interesting one. The worst year was 2016 when he didn't play at all. The second worst year is 2017 when he played once in the Farmers and missed the cut. Like, you know, for Tiger to have a bad year, he just can't show up.
Yeah, it's hard to remember how grim those 2 years were, actually, him in the car park and all that stuff.
I was just going to say that. It's just my fixed memory of those bad years is you with great sadness in your voice going, I'm just getting so tired of looking for Tiger in a car park.
There was a run there where he was just in the car park every Thursday night saying, yeah, no, my glutes didn't activate this time and it's not going to happen. Peter, was it so volatile at times that you might come out one day and have a slight fade and then another day a slight draw? Was it ever that extreme for you?
No, not really, no. No, it was always a little draw, if anything. Sometimes I'd probably overhook it, but generally it was a draw.
And if you come out in the morning on the driving range and it's starting to flirt from draw into hook, could you fix it there and then, or would you take the hook, the mini hook, onto the golf course?
No, you, there's different things. Like I was going to say to you, you'd probably tee the driver down a little bit more. It's probably more difficult to, you know, move it that much if the driver's down low. You were talking about a big slice there. If you go to a 3-wood, you won't have such a big slice. You know, a little bit more loft in it, gets the club face a little bit square. So when you're out playing in your beloved Killeen Castle, when you're standing up there, when this has been lifted and you want to hit that little shot onto the fairway, take out the 3-wood, tee it down really low and give it a good smack.
I know, but I don't like not making my 290 average, you know. Now, delighted to say we are joined by Stephanie Meadow, LPGA Tour player, and she is announcing, as well as all that, a new partnership with Amegis, a specialist division of the Taxback Group. So she will join Shane Lowry, a fellow ambassador, and we'll be seeing the logo on the shirt going forward. Stephanie, great to have you with us. How are things?
Doing well. Well, as good as you can be, really, in these times. But, just trying to stay busy. Very lucky here. The golf courses are still open, but... it's been a challenging time for everyone.
And here is Phoenix. We're seeing the sun behind you. So you're in Phoenix.
Yes. Yeah. it's getting really hot here. It was like record temperatures here. So I'm definitely ready for kind of kick off the season and get out of here for the summer.
What is a record temperature in Phoenix?
Well, it was 105 the other day. I'm not good at converting back to Celsius, but that's hot. I'm good at cold temperatures in Celsius and hot temperatures in Fahrenheit.
it gets hot there. I played golf in Scottsdale when it was 118 degrees, which is 47 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
like, hot. But you go out at like, it's so weird, isn't it, Stephanie? Like when you play, well, you don't pay for golf, but for punters like myself who pay for golf. So the tee times are funny. So if you, the most expensive tee times are like 5:45 a.m. to 10 a.m. So it's like $200. And then it goes down to like $60 from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Yeah.
Because like you'd want to be, you want to have a hole in your head to play golf in the summer in Arizona. And then the evening tee times kind of, you get like a discounted time because you've only got certain amounts of daylight. But the really expensive tee off times are like 6 a.m.
Yeah, definitely. And that's been kind of what I've been trying to do. Like it's 105 here at the minute, but so it's, you know, it's not quite as hot as that, but getting out in the mornings. And then I'm actually very lucky. My fiance's father has a cabin up in Prescott, Arizona, which is about an hour north of here. And it's 5,000 feet elevation. So it's 20 degrees cooler up there than it is here. Which is pretty cool. There's pine trees and all the rest of it. So I can play golf up there in a little cooler weather, which is nice.
Oh, excellent. Oh, very good. And what's your setup there? So you're with your fiance at the moment. Congratulations, by the way.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we're just at home. Our dog's here too. He's passed out beside me here. We're actually going to go up north later this afternoon to play a couple rounds up there. Just trying to stay busy. Our schedule just got kicked back again till mid-July. So, just trying to stay healthy and just stay out of everybody's way, really, and let the healthcare workers do their job.
Yeah. And is your mom back home, or is she out there, or what's the rest of the family all scattered around?
So my mom actually lives just down the street. So she's just like, so I met her in the morning there for a walk, but we just kind of social distance walk. My cousin and her kids are back at home in Dromore, and her husband actually works in the NHS. So it's been a bit of a, don't want to say challenging, but it's pretty nerve wracking. You know, he's trying to do his best, but it's nerve wracking for all the families.
Yeah, I mean, you think of the frontline workers, the NHS workers, it's the families waiting for them to come home every day that you feel so sorry for as well. Nerve-wracking is a great description of it. I mean, it's not, you don't want to say it's a daily wait for any bad news, but it's constantly hanging over the family. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, exactly. And it really doesn't look like it's getting any, you know, you worry about it every day and you don't know how long you're going to be worrying about it. So, and she's stuck at home with two kids, 5 and 3. And she's a school teacher. So, you know, it's a lot on their plate. So, you know, I really feel for all the people out there that are family of the healthcare workers for just, you know, it takes the whole family to be heroes, not just the actual healthcare.
Steph, what's the general attitude towards the lockdown restrictions in Arizona? I mean, it's one of my favorite places on earth. I absolutely adore that state. Loads of room. There's a real sense of the frontier where people kind of carve out their own life. I mean, I'm not saying on the beautiful gated communities of Phoenix, but I mean, just generally there's a kind of a, we carve out our own life attitude that I've always noticed in Arizona. So how does that square with like being told by Governor Doug is like, okay, everybody, you've got to take on these restrictions.
Very mixed. I was just at the golf course the other day and people are still convinced that it's, you know, just people are exaggerating and, you know, it's interesting, and especially with all the things that are going on in California, they have very strict lockdowns and people are talking about how ridiculous that is and that they just want to get back to normal life. And they're saying, oh, the California people, like one of my golf courses here is part of a group called True and Privé. So, the reciprocal type things. And they're like, oh, the California people just come down here. And I'm just like, so it's very mixed, you know. And then I have a friend who owns a restaurant in downtown Phoenix, and obviously, you know, it's really hurting them and it's hard to watch. You know, they can do carry out and it's just really hard. But I mean, my personal opinion is that, you know, the government seems to be doing the right things, you know, not opening up quite yet. We haven't really, I think we've had 6,000 cases here now, so we haven't been a hotspot by any means. But it's still scary because it could switch in a week. So
yeah, that is the thing. So in, you mentioned there the LPGA. So the restart, it's going to be July 15th when you guys get back underway in Michigan. Of the 34 events I was reading on the LPGA Tour, 9 have been cancelled and 13 have been rescheduled. So the PGA I saw now has moved to October. So the plan is, I mean, the PGA Tour is going to get back underway, I think, June 11th. So you're all looking at July 15th, you hope, subject to change, who knows what's around the corner kind of a thing.
Yeah, you know, the email just came out yesterday, and basically one of our biggest issues, probably more than the PGA has, is that we're more international. So I think there's about 35% of us that are overseas. So you're dealing with, you know, getting back here, then they have to quarantine, you know, there's a bunch of different things that are going on. So I think that's maybe why we're a little behind the PGA. If they do start in June, who knows? But you know, then you look at our schedule and we're starting in Michigan and New Jersey, which is not super ideal because they're kind of hotspot areas and they could be the last to open up. So honestly, I'm just trying to think, okay, we're starting July, prepare like we're starting for July until told elsewise. And then I won't kind of be caught off guard because it could be easy to kind of just, oh, it's not going to happen. And then you're not ready.
Mm. Are you looking, say, one of the things that I looked on the rejig schedule is, so you've got the Evian Championship, which is obviously one of the big events, is on the schedule for the 6th to the 9th of August. But then this week, the French government announced that all sporting events are going to be suspended until September. So, like, how do you square those two things up?
Yeah, we've been talking about that too. You know, who knows? I would expect probably an announcement at some point to say that it might not happen. You know, same thing about the British and the Scottish, you know, who knows there either. There's just so many variables. Like, even if they do allow it, you know, what if we get there and they make us quarantine for 14 days? Well, you can't have a tournament the next week, you know, so it's, there's just so many variables. And I know the LPGA, they have bought testing equipment and they're talking about doing testing every week and of players and caddies and even the cameras that do the temperature reading, you know, they're talking about doing that as well. So yeah, it could look very different. It's a bit scary. I'm not sure I'm quite ready to get on a plane yet, you know, but it's my job. And hopefully by that time, things will be a bit more settled.
I was listening to your commissioner, Mike Wan, who, well, I mean, he's echoing what everyone is saying in golf, but that the pandemic is going to have a, and I'm quoting, a staggering impact on the finances of the LPGA. Can you, I mean, do you know, I mean, are players informed about this? Are you aware? Like, how does this impact on you guys? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I have to say the LPGA, they've actually been pretty good about getting information to us. He's been doing videos that he's been sending to us, and basically he's saying, you know, there definitely we're going to have some troubles. He's not expecting it to be, you know, we're 10 years ago where we only had 9 events and, you know, that sort of thing. But he's saying that they've saved a lot of money over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years that will kind of feed out of that. I was encouraged to see that of the tournaments that got cancelled, they donated some of their prize funds to other tournaments. So the tournaments that we have left have bigger purses, which I was not expecting at all. You know, I was actually thinking that maybe some of the purses might have been cut just because of these companies are hurting or we can't do fans, then that hurts them as well, obviously. So he's saying it's going to be rough, but it's not going to be awful is what kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Well, as you said,
that's really well done, because if you look at the European Tour, what Keith Pelly sent out to the players, and you know, the tour is going to be completely different. There's going to be prize funds are going to be severely hit. There's going to be no courtesy cars. There's going to be no lounges or very few. So he's done a great job, if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we'll have to wait and see just exactly, but I mean, very encouraged by the prize funds to be kind of spread there. I think he's done a pretty good job with rescheduling too, but you know, who knows? I mean, they've also done a great job of kind of informing us, you know, if we start in July, is it going to count as a season? if we start in, you know, September, what are the options? You know, so they're trying to talk about maybe doing like just combining the whole seasons. So 2020 and 2021 will just be one season if there's not enough events. So nobody's going to lose their card because of all this, or reshuffle within the LPGA and no new members if we get enough events in 2020. So there's different things that, you know, he's been pretty good at outlining so that we're not totally scared, you know, which is nice. But who knows? I mean, it really, I knew that, well, in my head, I was thinking mid-June was definite no-go for us. Now mid-July sounds a bit more achievable. Mm.
And to echo something you said, Steph, it's to quote Mike Wan, he said, "We saved more money in the last 10 years than in the 60 years before. But it's possible in 2020 we could eat up most of the savings we saved over the course of the 10 months." So they have a war chest that can last 10 months. And
yeah,
I mean, given the ever-changing nature of news and the state of this virus globally, who the hell knows what happens next week, never mind in 10 months' time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, it is very encouraging. But at the same time point, you know, PGA Tour probably has God knows how much more to see of their players, but at least we have something, you know. And I know that, you know, they're trying to help out players where they can. You know, there's a few government funded things here that they've been really good about telling us, hey, you can apply for this. This applies to you. So they've been really good. I mean, they're itching to get back too.
Yeah. The PGA Tour, I think, are counting their all their lucky ducklings that they signed that TV contract about a week before this whole thing kicked off. It's one of the great coups of any sporting contract. But $2.7 million is the average. $2.7 million per event is the average now going forward, which isn't bad on the LPGA Tour over the next couple of months, hopefully. What about you thus far then? I know there was a shoulder injury in the off season. There were a couple of good finishes in Australia, I think two top 20 finishes. So how has 2020 as it's been thus far? How has it been for you on a playing front, Steph?
So my first event was in Florida and I had the shoulder injury. It kind of was a lot longer than I was hoping for. So I ended up, I only played one round of 18 holes going into the Florida event. So it was a bit nerve-wracking, but I finished like 30-something there. So I was really pleased that I was kind of able, from what I thought, I was pretty rusty, not being able to play and put in a good finish. And then in Australia, I played great too. Wasn't super impressed with my Sunday finishes in Australia. I kind of had crappy days the last 2 days. Wasn't easy conditions either Sunday, but I felt like I could have, you know, at least one of them been up there a bit more. But honestly, it was a great start. It was nice to get off to, you know, make a bit of money and kind of get going because, you know, it makes it so much easier when you start well. So that was kind of my plan. And I was kind of getting there and then obviously devastated to stop. And what I thought was just going to be a China tournament cancellation has turned into till July. So a bit of a bummer, but just trying to get healthy. Like I've had a ton of injuries over the last 6 months and it's very frustrating. So I'm kind of using this time to do all the little physio things and get strong and which I might not have been able to do if we were constantly playing. So I'm trying to take the positives out of it and make sure that, you know, once we do get going, because we're going to play a lot of events in a row, that I can play them and not have any injuries anymore and be done with that.
What are you working on when you are working on your game at the moment? I mean, the women's game, increasingly I enjoy watching it more than the men's game because too often with the standard PGA Tour events with the men, it's bomb a drive, doesn't matter if it goes in the rough, gouge it out with a wedge onto the green. You know, the power game is alive and well in the men's game. The women's game doesn't seem to be as dominated by power, but I could be misreading that. What's your sense of what's most important in the women's game now? It seems to me we can see a different variety of players doing very well.
Yeah, I think it's not just so much power. Like there definitely are power hitters out there, like Lexi Thompson, you know, she bombs it. There are a few that bomb it, but I think the average distance is definitely increasing. But it's definitely more about wedges and putting and short game. You know, men's tour, they're hitting every par 5 and 2. Our tour, maybe one, maybe two of the holes are reachable, unless you're like at the top 1% of distance. So seeing more of that being essential kind of for wedges and putting. I mean, same thing I always work on. Honestly, I've been playing a lot. Like, I just trying to get out on the golf course and have fun, because I'm not a huge practicer anymore. And with not having like any kind of close goal, it can get a bit like, oh. So I enjoy getting out in the golf course and kind of like playing with my friends for some money, or you know, there's a few girls that are members at my golf course that are LPGA players, so we get out and just play. So that's kind of been kind of a nice distraction.
I was going to ask you is about the collegial nature of the LPGA tour. Is this like, so you have a group of friends and you would play regularly together, you know, have a little side bet, and that way, so it kind of fosters, so you don't feel like you're an isolated unit within the broader LPGA tour.
Yeah, no, not at all. At Silverleaf, we have, I think, 4 or 5 LPGA players now. So, you know, we're doing walking, or at Silverleaf, honestly, you can't even really walk because there's such long distances in between holes. But, you know, we go out with, even Kyle will play, and maybe Christy's husband will come out and play, and we play a couples match, or, you know, so I don't feel totally isolated, which is really nice. And it is nice to have, you know, somebody that you'll be competing against in the future that you can play against now. It kind of feels a bit better when you win, as opposed to just like beating, you know, who knows who. But, you know, winning's winning. So it's good prep.
That was an interesting thing you said there. I'm not as big a practicer anymore. That suggests at a certain point you just had practiced so much in your life that you couldn't bear to just practice anymore. What's gone on there?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it came probably 3 years ago when I had the back stuff. Like, I used to just want to beat balls. Like, part of it's the injury thing, and then the other part of it is just I don't see any benefit in it anymore. You know, like, I have learned a lot about how I perform well, and I think being on the golf course and hitting shots and being competitive is a lot more beneficial to my game than just standing on the range for 3 hours and trying to work on some technique thing. So that kind of mindset shift has made me want to play more and not be stuck on the range. Yeah, because I just don't see anything. Like, I used to think I was getting better doing that, and now I kind of know I'm not, so I just don't do it.
Right. You know, because it's very tempting for all of us to stand at the range and hit shots and get into the flow, and you feel like you're improving. Is there any particular reason you felt you weren't getting something out of it? Is it something anyone said to you, or just a conclusion you reached yourself? Because I guess, you know, there's times we've gone to a driving range and you start hitting 107 irons on a flat surface, and then you realize on the course, I haven't hit 1 7 iron today, and it hasn't been on a flat surface once.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, some of it's through the sports psych stuff, but I think younger me was like, oh, like, if I just get this one little technique thing down, I'm going to be 2 shots better on the golf course. And then you start realizing that, like, there's so much more to it. And even when you got it and it looks pretty on camera, like, I go out on the golf course and it's just like this if I'm still thinking about it. So, yeah, I just think it's so important to get out there and, you know, get in match play situations, pressure situations. Like, you'll learn or you'll perform so much better if you're doing that, you know, on a daily basis. And then you go to a tournament, then you're ready for it, as opposed to just like standing on a range. You're just, I mean, you practice what you get, you know, what you practice, you get good at, right? So I was just getting good at standing on a flat lie, hitting a 7 iron. And in LPGA golf, you know, you might have a couple of par threes where you hit 7 iron off a tee, but that's about it. So I think that's why it's so important. And honestly, I really enjoy playing a lot more than practicing anyway. So it's fun to socialize with people and play matches, get the adrenaline. It's just better, I think.
Stephanie, looking back when I played, about the last time I played was 2015, 2016 in Morocco. And it was the same time that the ladies had an event. And I was always amazed at how poorly the ladies were treated in, you know, coming to a tournament, the actual facilities that they were given, the amount of, you know, service from the suppliers and stuff like that. Well, the men's game got, you know, the tour trucks and you know, all the niceties of life on tour. So what is the LPGA like in relation to that? Do they look after you well? Do they, you know, is there trucks there? Is there stuff like that?
Yeah. So it wouldn't be the same. We have one truck, which is basically like a building, like club building truck. It's not the specific company's truck as the PGA would have. But they do send reps. Like Callaway, I always have two reps there every week, one or two, mostly two. And then if anything needs done, then they go in that truck and, you know, build whatever needs to be. PXG always has a rep there, and Ping always has a rep there. So, and they do look after us. Like, I mostly have Callaway stuff, and they, you know, anything I ever need is there. Either they have it or it's there the next day, which is really nice. I think that's gotten better. And the other companies too, if you wanted something, they would get it for you. No Titleist there, that for clubs, there's a lady there who does all the balls and shoes and stuff like that. So she puts that into our locker. But I think overall it's probably changed a little bit. We still don't, you know, courtesy cars and things like that, like the top 10, 20 girls might get them. And then at majors, everybody gets them. So like KPMG or ANA, everybody gets a car. So kind of special events. But it definitely, I think it's come a long way, but it's still nowhere near what the PGA Tour or even really the European Men's Tour would be.
Okay, and I hope a whole lot better than the ladies' European Tour, yeah. I would presume.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I've heard a lot of stories where the ladies' European Tour girls are trying to get clubs and, you know, companies aren't giving them to them. And, you know, that's not easy at all. But hopefully it'll get better. I mean, they did have a better schedule this year until all this stuff happened. But maybe, I don't know, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, I was just saying to the lads there just before you came on, like when I was finishing in 2016, it was actually quite difficult to get equipment. You know, you'd have to wait until the staff players got their stuff first, and then you were given the new driver, the new, you know, to try out. But I'm presuming it's probably got a little bit more difficult as the years have gone on, even for, you know, the top, whatever, top 50 players in the world or whatever. But, you know, it's good to hear that at least, you know, the manufacturers are out there and they're promoting their gear with the right people.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've bounced around a little bit in the last year. I had some PXG stuff in my bag and kind of gone back to Callaway now. And, you know, they're just, they want people to play their stuff. Like, that's the bottom line. So it doesn't really matter where you've been or who you've got. They want you to try it. And they're both very knowledgeable. I mean, Barry, the LPGA rep, the Callaway rep for LPGA, has been out there for a long time. So he knows what he's doing, which is nice.
Would I be right in saying PXG has they've kind of plateaued a little bit? They were on this massive big curve, you know, they'd put an awful lot of money into their advertising and the players, and then all of a sudden they've plateaued a little bit in relation to the other manufacturers.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. I actually knew the PGA rep that is no longer with them. He's a member of the golf course that I'm a member at out there, and it's kind of interesting, you know, once he left, a couple of the other PhD tour players said see you later, like Chaz Reavy, I think, and Horschel. So yeah, it'll be interesting over the next few years or maybe even the next year just to see where they go. But I think they were very exciting, and you know, I liked that. I still have their hybrid in my bag. I really like their hybrid. I think it's really good, but the irons just, I don't know, I just couldn't stop hitting it left. if I hit it great, it was like high, soft, really nice. And then the other ones were just like, phew. So yeah, that went quickly out of the bag. So, but I don't know. I mean, they seem like they have good stuff, but I'm not sure if the business plan is really working.
Yeah, but like for the average Joe punter, they're very, very expensive in comparison to the other manufacturers. And that's why I was just wondering, would they be still around in the next couple of years?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I know our rep, as far as I know, is still going to be out there, but I think the decreasing of playing their clubs might have an effect on that.
Yeah.
This is great. This is how actual professional golfers talk. This is...
Yeah. They nerd out on equipment.
The lads are saying
it's
the nerdiest conversation.
Sorry, yeah.
That was great. That was actually fascinating to listen in on. Peter, I was curious, what were your thoughts the way Stephanie was describing the relationship with the driving range?
Well, I was going to butt in, you know what I mean? All her injuries. I spent €13 in tour and I wasn't injured once. I was going to promote my Coke and Mars bars tour, yeah. And, you know, get away from the gym and just play golf. But yeah, look, that worked for me. But Stephanie is doing very well in the States now. So I'm not going to say a word. But no, I think she's right, to be honest with you. The more you can work on your short game and keep away from the range, the more you will progress and the more money you'll get in your bank account at the end of the year.
Stephanie, before earlier on, before you came on, we were talking about players who have an ability to play with the swing that they have on that particular week. So whether it's Rory or Tiger or Jack, rather than have this one swing, and if it's not happening the way you want, they have to fix it or they get the coach in. Like, can you play with whatever's happening in your swing at that time?
In the last year, yes. Previous, no.
okay.
I think with what I've been kind of working on now, I've been working on the same things for quite a while, and that's kind of like my little box that I'm going to stay in, right? I'm not going to experiment too much because I think what I have is what I can work with, and it can be consistent. So where in the past I would have like freaked out if, you know, after a round, try to find something new or whatever that little kind of little tiny fix is going to somehow magically change my weekend, which is just not going to happen. So I think with what I have now, I have some very simple keys where like, okay, if it's going left, do this, if it's going right, do this. And it's not complicated and it's something that I always keep going back to. And I think that has helped me be a bit more consistent. You know, I went to a golf academy, so I used to have, you know, textbook. You have the all these step one should be here, step two should be here, step three, you know, and that's just not me. You know, I wish it was me. Like, some people are like that. Like, you know, Adam Scott and Van Damme, like, they have these picture perfect swings, but 99% of us don't, and we just deal with what we have and figure out how to get around.
What do you think of, I mean, to get you dragging in on the Brandel Chamblee giving out about the dominant influence of golf coaches that are teaching a particular type of swing. What's your thought on kind of more idiosyncratic swings that you used to see much more, say, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good. I think a good way to look at it, and I kind of learned this from my coach now, is that, you know, you have all the you know, you have the TPI stuff, right, which is all the muscular, you know, your body can be in this position but can't be in this position. And then, but you also have like the skeletal level too, where people just cannot do certain things because of their bone structure. So like me, for example, like I'm not super tall, I'm 5'4", but my arms are really short. and so they're only like 5'1" or something like that. So for me to have like this big upright swing or what I would feel maybe is picture perfect is actually really upright for me. And when you start thinking it in terms of that, it starts making sense of why people started swinging the way they did. And then you see people make swing changes, and some might work out because it might be okay for their body, and others are completely terrible, like career ruining changes. So I think in knowing that now, like for example, my first lesson with my coach now, he did all these tests of how my body moved and measurements and arms short and all the rest of it. And he hadn't seen me swing yet. Well, maybe he would have seen like Instagram swings, which were not really what I would have swung like when I was, you know, 18 or 17 at home. And he said, I guarantee when you played well, you were flat inside and hit a draw. And at the time I was super upright and like was trying to hit a cut. And I went back and I showed him a college swing, and there I am, flat as can be and inside and draw. And that's just like what my body is built for. So that was kind of me sold in 30 seconds of the first lesson. But, you know, it makes sense. That's why people have weird looking swings, because everybody's different.
That's absolutely fascinating.
That is absolutely, yeah, brilliant.
I remember seeing Paul McGinley swing a club the first time, and the commentator was saying, yeah, he's always swung the club flat and around himself. And it just jumps out to me. He's not a big man. You know, like Monty had this big, you know, the high upright swing, but he's got long levers. He's a tall man. You've long arms, Peter, if that's not too weird a thing to say to somebody else. I didn't notice that about you.
Is that the first compliment you've ever given me?
I don't know. Is it a compliment? But it's an observation.
All right. Yeah.
But you do. Yeah, you have long levers.
Yes, yeah, and I would have swung the club quite upright, all right, yeah.
Right. So there could be some sucker with short arms like me who wants an upright swing and they just need to face reality.
Absolutely.
Or you could be me, who's 5'7" with short arms. So I have a very flat swing.
Okay.
Precisely. And it's, do you know what's so funny? It goes to show that when you're talking, so we have two people here who really know golf. And it's like, there's a whole other level of knowledge that like I will never access, but I am endlessly fascinated by. And it's exactly that, like, because like I've often, like you, at my much, much lesser level, I have yearned for many, many years to have a prettier swing, like, you know, nice and upright with a big extended. I'm like, I'm 52 years old and there ain't no way I'm going to develop I'm never getting a 22-year-old body ever again that's really limber and loose. So I have to make do with what I've got. And it's so, I have to say, it's quite, and I'm sure listeners who would be handicapped golfers will take great confidence in knowing that, like, at a top-end professional level, that a coach is going, look, you have to be able to swing with what you've got rather than some imaginary golf swing that you just can't reach.
Exactly.
Well, it's a game of mistakes, isn't it, in so many ways, and accepting your limitations. And there's so many players, and I mean, even you said it, Peter, when we're watching on the TV every week, they're the players in contention, so they're having a good week, they're playing well. But if you drop down the other end, you'll see a lot of very average golf, and it's almost about accepting the limitations with your swing, you know, to play really good golf, to stay confident, I think, in effect.
It is. And funny enough, you were saying what we were talking about, Joe, about, you know, playing with what you have and not worrying about your swing. When you are going through a swing change of some shape or form, your numbers will be all over the place. You will shoot 85 when 85 was never, ever in your repertoire of numbers to shoot. So when you actually go through a leaderboard, and you scroll all the way down the bottom and work your way back up again, have a look the next time you're going through it. And people shooting these numbers, and you can say, right, they're making a swing change, because it's totally not. Normally they're, you know, if they're going to miss the cut, they miss by one, miss by two at most. But when they miss by plenty, you know yourself straight away, they're going for a swing change. Because swing changes with a card in your hand can have awful consequences, as Stephanie will probably be able to tell you now better than I can.
Yeah, it's a bit scary.
And Stephanie, when we talked to you last year, it was very interesting. You were saying one of the things you had kind of maybe realized a little bit is that when you're fired up, you know, and feeling fiery on a golf course is when you often produce your best stuff. But I suppose, like anyone, you were searching for best practice when it came to psychology, and psychology would often preach calmness and a certain zen, and you had to kind of navigate, well, what's best for me? And you seemed like you were saying towards the end of last year, you'd come to the conclusion that being fired up to an extent, I'm sure, but being fired up was best for you. So have you settled on that now? Is that kind of the space you're trying to get into when you're playing your golf, or when you were before all this stopped?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I felt like in Florida or the first event of this year, after not having that grid of preparation, like I wanted to go back into this kind of like put my shell on, be super calm, like, you know, oh, don't think about anything, you know, no expectations. And I felt myself going back into that. And I said, wait a second here, like this is not what I do. Like, I'm not doing that anymore. And it was amazing to just see like how just thinking about that mindset could change so many different things. And I wholeheartedly believe that now, that that's the best for me. And obviously, like you said, within reason, you don't want to have your heart rate 180 hitting a golf ball, but you know, just a little bit more pumped up, a little bit more, competitive, and letting that side out. And, you know, it's just like you're a kid going out and you're going to beat somebody. Like, they don't think about being calm, you know. They just, they're five, you know, they want to make the putt, and they get excited when they make it. So it's kind of, you know, going back to those roots, and I really think it's working for me.
Great. Well, listen, you've been so good with your time. It's been great to have you on. The plan is, well, I guess everyone's plan. Try and practice whatever way you can for the next 2 months and then hope that it's July and you're ready to hit the ground running. It's going to be so weird for so many players after a long break.
Yeah, it's going to be very strange. And, you know, even just thinking about like how many events you're going to play in a row, because you could, you know, there's only 2 weeks off between mid-July and like December 20th. So it's going to be definitely a process, probably just trying to figure out as we go along. But yeah, like I said, just keep that July date like it's set, even though it's not, and try to prepare like it was and be ready, because I mean, there's no time to waste. You could blink and not be ready, and 5 events have gone by in 5 weeks and you've lost the opportunity. So yeah, that's the plan.
Okay, excellent. Well, listen, we wish you well. Again, Stephanie was here in part because she's announced a new partnership with Immedius, a specialist division of the Taxback Group, along with Shane Lowry now. She's an ambassador. So Hopefully we'll be seeing the logo on the shirt come July.
Yeah, it's here. Stephanie, yeah.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah. I honestly, like, just to give them a shout out, like in a time like this, I've been talking to them. We've been trying to get this all rolled out probably since like December of last year, but things have come up. But for a company like that to still support me in this sort of time when, you know, sponsors are dropping left, right and center, just says a lot about them. And I'm thrilled to be a part of the team, especially with someone like Shane. So it's very exciting.
Great. Well, listen, congrats on that and best of luck over the coming months. Thanks a million, Stephanie. We'll let you go.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, bye. Stephanie.
There we are. Stephanie Meadow, who is doing great things on the LPGA Tour. A really interesting thinker about the game, Peter. You know, some golfers, I'm a stand up and hit it merchant types. She's not that. She never has been anytime we've spoken to her. She's full of well thought out approaches to the game.
Yeah, seems to be very level headed. Very successful college life in America, and you know, they teach you very well over there and in the schools of you know, how to approach things and how to work things out. So you know, I wish her all the best going forward, and I think, you know, this could be her next year, it could be her year.
Yeah, you know? hopefully. And you know, we've had her on before. So if that's the first time you've heard us talk to Stephanie, we've talked to her a bit more about her career in depth. There was no need to rehash it all now. But I mean, she, amazing college career, as Peter said, burst onto the scene in her very first, I think it was her first professional tournament. It was the US Open, and she finished third or fourth from memory. So she burst on the scene in 2014 with an amazing US Open. Her father very sadly passed away the following year. That obviously had a profound effect on her in various ways and affected her game. And a couple of years where she's been getting back and hoping to fulfill all the potential. And she retained her LPGA Tour card last year at the death, an amazing putt from 20 plus feet. So there was a real sense the momentum was back, and hopefully it still is. I mean, these are strange times now, but that's where she is in her career, if you hadn't heard her interviewed before. And very impressive, Fionn.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, for someone who obviously had enormous natural talent, and as you both have said, remarkable college career, you'd have to say, in respect to her ability, a kind of a stuttering professional career, in part to do with personal circumstances, but also injuries. So hopefully, as she was saying there, that she's had time to kind of strengthen up and really work on those areas that perhaps were prone to injury. She's clearly a smarter golfer. But more than all of that, and of course, you know, I wish her nothing but success, I think she's an amazing ambassador for Irish sport. Like, she's so, like, she's thoughtful, she's articulate, she's funny, she's relaxed, she's all of those things that you want out of an Irish sports person. And like, honestly, I could sit and listen to her talk about golf for all day long.
Yeah, she's great. Hopefully we'll check in with her again. So best of luck to her over the next while. The point she made, Peter, about the swing to suit the body has always struck me. I hadn't heard it verbalized as clearly as that, and that it was so measurable. It's really interesting. Her coach, just by looking at her various measurements, was able to tell her how she swung the club when she swung it at her best. So there are probably the shorter player out there who has been told, oh, your swing's a bit flat there, you know, you want to get it a bit more upright. That just may not be possible.
Everything is, you know, built around your limitations. Never mind your bone structure or your muscles. It's, you know, how you actually see yourself playing the game. And we're not talking about professionals here. We're talking about amateurs who are going to their local pro for a lesson or coming to the driving range for lessons. The pro really has to decide how much this person can actually take in, yeah. How much they can, you know, understand what I'm saying. Some people are much better at describing a situation than others, and using the right words that the amateur can understand. Well, okay, I have to try and do this, or I have to try and do that to fix the way I play golf. And we've all seen, you know, Porrick Harrington doing his Twitter videos there on how to play the game. And I've been talking to a few other pros, and they're all amazed at how simplified he's actually made it. And what they can actually learn from him teaching how to teach better. So golf is, it's a very difficult game, but a very easy game sometimes as well. And it's a very easy game to teach, but then it's also a very difficult game to teach, yeah, depending on your student. And I should know, having you as a student for about 30 minutes, we just destroyed each other.
I knew after 30 seconds that this was, I needed to get away from this. Step away, step away. Don't listen. Harrington is simplifying it massively, is he? I mean, I presume he could get really deep into his jargon.
He has simplified it. His basic lessons at the start, if people go back and look at his Twitter, his basic lessons at the start were excellent. And they also give the amateur golfer, the general, whatever, even 20 handicapper, a fair idea of what to do and what not to do. And by taking that in and maybe going for a lesson now yourself, or you know, whilst you're listening to the program afterwards, it'll give you a good idea of how the golf swing should be swung. And it can improve your the way you play golf.
Okay, very good. I've only one last thing to bring up, which is tangential to everything that we've kind of mentioned and brings it together. It's a combination of a driving range question, and you also mentioned at the start, Peter, about how people want to hit off the grass. So as a professional, hitting off the mats is not something you would have had to do all that often, I suspect. What's the downside of practicing and doing most of your practice off the mats? I mean, I can figure a guess or two, but really, in technical terms, what's the downside?
Well, first of all, depending on the quality of mats, you can get very good mats and very average mats, but the club can bounce quite a lot, and it doesn't give you a true sensation of your impact position. So if you're hitting turf and then ball on a mat, the club will bounce into the ball and you'll get a result. If you were on the grass, you'd probably duff it. Mm. That's one thing. The other thing is a little bit of stability. You know, when you're out in the golf course, you don't get such a flat lie that you would normally get off a mat. And then the other thing in the driving range, people come to the driving range and they beat balls, but they forget that it's not all about hitting it as hard as you possibly can. And sometimes that's what happens in driving ranges and out in your practice fairway. You're not really bothered where it's going. You're more concerned about how hard you can hit it. If people would come to a driving range or a practice fairway and learn, right, I'm going to try and shape this shot a little bit, or I'm going to try and hit 10 shots towards the 200-yard marker. And that's a whole lot better than standing there and beating the you know what out of the ball for half an hour.
It's funny, actually. I've been... just out of pure nothing else to do, I've been watching a lot of those Golf Pass, the Martin Hall lessons on Sky Sports.
He's excellent. And
he is excellent. But it's one of the things that this lockdown has done is reveal the sheer quality of golfer who can really talk about their swing or impart some knowledge about why they do things they do. And the two that really stood out to me this week were Laura Davies. I think I mentioned her on the pod, but Annika Sorenstam, and they echoed exactly that about tailored practice. Is that, like, you know, you can take a double bucket of balls and you just hit them. But if you hit 20 balls over the course of an hour, but every shot is deliberate, has a destination, you're trying to do something, it's a much more effective way to practice. And now, needless to say, I doubt I'll ever be able to chip a shot quite as beautifully as Annika Sorenstam can. And it's really something. It's just like it's glorious to watch. And you realize, and again, it kind of echoes something that I thought when we were listening to Stephanie and yourself, Peter, is that Joe and I, perhaps, you know, who love golf and who read about golf all the time and try and play it as much as we can, there's a level of understanding that we will never exceed to, ever, try as we might. You know, you can read all the manuals, you can know all of the mechanics, et cetera, et cetera. But we will never exceed to that level of golf that you guys have in the professional tour. And if you are lucky enough, you have the ability to impart that knowledge to amateurs like us.
But sometimes it's actually, it's practical knowledge rather than in a theory book.
Sure.
You know, it's something that we've done and we've learned how to do it. It's like a kid riding a bike. You know, they get up onto the bike and they have the stabilizers, and then all of a sudden they take the stabilizers off and they've nearly taught themselves how to cycle. And a lot of golfers would be like that. You could go down the range and ask, you know, Bubba Watson, how does he hit this banana fade? Well, I just stand there and I do that. And a lot of golfers would be like that. They would.
Do you think so?
Yeah, they would find it quite difficult to verbalize or even put it in writing what they actually do.
Well, so that kind of confirms a prejudice, I guess, that I would have had anyway, going back for years, thinking that it's a rare gift. I think one of the things that this lockdown has shown me is that it's not just three golfers who know how to talk about the swing. It's not just Padraig Harrington. I think Rory McIlroy has an amazing ability to talk about his golf swing. And the aforementioned, your Annika Sorenstams, your Laura Davies. I think Nick Doherty has an amazing ability to talk about it. But I also think even Ian Poulter has this very, very accessible way of talking or explaining why he does things a certain way. And I'm just curious as to what that percentage of golfers who can talk about their golf swing to the amateur or to the non-expert versus those that just kind of go, well, I don't know. I wonder if DJ, you just go, so DJ, why do you, like, what's your chipping action? And you know, there's a part of me even this week was convinced that if I was standing next to DJ and I asked him a bunch of questions, he'd be able to explain it to me.
It just goes to show you what lockdown does.
Yeah, perhaps. But I must say, it's been a. I don't know about you, Joe. Like, I mean, I know you're as mad for this kind of stuff as I am. But I have to say, I mean, it's the one thing in sport on television in a non-sporting landscape that I've enjoyed more than anything is these lessons with players that you wouldn't ordinarily see on TV.
Yeah, no, I do enjoy them. I must say, in the last year, having had maybe close to a decade of something approaching addiction to all those instruction videos on YouTube, like genuinely, like just playing games of golf, coming home, watching them, going out, practicing the next secret. And it wasn't really getting me anywhere. And I would say in the last 18 months, I've really toned down how much of that stuff I'm watching, because there is no universal advice, really.
No.
It ties in with the point that Stephanie made there, where our bodies are all so different with different length arms. What works for Montgomery, you know, this little secret that he has for his chipping doesn't work for me because we're so different. So I went to see David Keating in Peter's place in the last year and, you know, really started making improvements. And I said, right, I'm just going to listen to David. I'm going to stick with that. And it definitely decluttered me, and it decluttered me on the golf course as well. I had less technical thoughts in my head. I just had one message when I played each round, made a massive difference. The other thing which I found it during lockdown as well, and it ties in what Peter's saying, what Stephanie's saying. I got into single figures this year, which is a big thing, never thought I'd do. But I remember when I really started playing well, there was one day I was out in Portmarnock Links and I was playing with a bunch of people, hadn't played well. Portmarnock Links can be a tough course, I find. And I stayed for, it's no exaggeration. I stayed for 3 hours afterwards just chipping. Because I don't never practice my short game. It was a beautiful summer's evening. I didn't have to be anywhere. So I practiced my chipping. I was reminded of it during lockdown because what I really got to grips with and really started to enjoy almost in like the silence and the tranquility of the chipping was that each lie is that little bit different. So the mistake I think I've made with golf for too long and probably amateurs make when they get too technical is walk up to a ball and don't give enough appreciation to the lie. Whereas the lie is everything. And I was thinking, you know, too much, well, this is just my technique, you know, so I'm doing my technique regardless of the lie. And how I relate that to lockdown. So I really played around with it that day and, you know, made huge strides. And I just felt my chipping was much better ever since. Just, you know, you get these moments in your game.
I can testify to that. Your chipping is much better.
You get these moments. It's why golf is so special, spiritual, wonderful in so many ways. You do get these moments of rapid development and they often are very memorable evenings on your own, often a summer evening. I'd say Peter had dozens and dozens of them as a teenager growing up. And they're so exciting. They're almost very private and you're so in the moment. I think that's why you remember them so well, because you're immersed in them.
And obviously, Joe, you weren't married at this stage where you could spend those 3 hours out there. Oh, you were at that stage.
This was a Friday on my day off work and my wife was away and I was playing the next day with Paul, actually, at Colleen and Ivor. I didn't have to be home. She was away for the evening. So I thought, well, I'm just going to stay here until 8 o'clock and go home and get a pizza. Like, it was one of the great days. But it's interesting.
One of the great evenings of your life.
To round off the point, I have been watching those tutorials, Fionn, but I've been out in my back garden and I haven't been able to buy a lawnmower yet because I'm newly in the house. But I have 6 Pro V1 balls in my little lunchbox out there and I've got my 58 degree wedge. So I've been out the back garden. Like, the grass is like it's up to my midway calf height, but then it's trampled down in parts. So out there in this small space, I've got a gazillion different lies. So I've enjoyed over the last few weeks throwing the balls up, letting them fall as they may. And sometimes you've got lovely, perfect, fluffy lie, and other times bet down, dug into it, and actually just figuring out what's the right stance here. What's the right angle for the club? And do I really keep that shut all the way through? Or do I let it open? Or do I release it, you know, long release, short release? All the kind of tiny, I think that's how you learn, actually, those tiny little differences in the game. And that's the antithesis of the driving range experience. But, you know, it makes the game so much richer, I think, when you're out there and you're playing the game as opposed to playing swing golf. So actually, when I talk about my game or think about my game at the moment, not that anyone cares, hence we're doing it at the end of the podcast, but when I do, I'm less looking at TV tutorials and I'm more really enjoying just like the minutiae of my 58 degree wedge in different grass.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's absolutely, and I echo all of that. My version is I was in Fuerteventura this time last year and I went to play golf and I happened on 2 fellas who from Ireland. One of them happened to be Alan Staunton, who was the head pro at Hollywood Lakes at the time, or he was just moving on from there. And I played with him and his brother-in-law, and Alan turned out that he's a really, really good putting coach. So he gave me a putting lesson, and exactly what you described. So taking just Alan's very simple tips, but very effective tips, I've taken them onto a green of an evening. Oh, and my golf course is 10 minutes away. I can cycle up there in 8. And I've sat on the 18th green of a quiet evening when no one else is playing, put 3 balls down, and just gone through that putting. And it's exactly what you described, that spiritual, that sense of connection to everything is just wonderful. And then I might tip off the green and, you know, don't say anything to my head greenkeeper, but I might chip onto the green from just off it. But it's exactly what you described. It's that feeling. And I'm working with just that one tip or one set of tips from one person. I'm not trying to combine anything else. I'm not trying to go, oh, I've got the secret or anything like that. And it is, it's a, it's a magical, magical thing. And I know Peter, I can see Peter smirking away, going, these two boys.
No, no, I've never, I'm just
I've never needed
to
make
here.
A 20 footer.
I'm waiting to get in my point. I said some months ago, I called Joe a golf perv. And do you know what, Fionn? You're a golf perv too. The two of you are the exact same.
I hold my hands up. Yeah, and yeah. It is.
Joe didn't
it's,
like being called a golf perv, but he definitely is.
I felt perv was just the wrong word. I liked
it. It's just probably a little judgy. It's a bit judgy. No, I think, listen, I took up golf when I was 32. I was very late to the game. I didn't play when I was a kid. I played, like, my dad played and then gave up before I was born. I come from a family of golfers, but I was never introduced to golf as a child. So for me, my golfing, I stopped playing football and I wanted something to do. And for me, it was golf. But I hacked my way for 15 years, like taking a lesson, going to a guy for a lesson and then not going back for a year and a half. And, you know, and only, I have to say, it's terrible. I'm the poster child for how not to learn how to play golf. But I must say, everything Joe said, I echo wholeheartedly. And it's not a coincidence that we both, well, when I was in Ireland, we used to play golf an awful lot together, because I think this little group of us have a very similar approach, and we're all, you know, handicapped amateurs, but it doesn't matter. It's still of a summer's evening. It's something.
It is gorgeous. Yeah. You must, Peter, have had so many of those evenings. I don't know where you practiced or where you played, but where you were the only one there and the sun was going down, and you must have had breakthroughs, and you were just so excited to get home and go to bed so you could go back out the next day and play with the breakthrough.
To be honest, I was very, very lucky. When I was in college, I did a big comp by night. So being in UCD, you had the ability to be a member of Portmarnock, like a student membership.
Yeah.
For 4 years. And I was a member for 4 years. So I had what you described during the day. You know, I went to college at 6:30. And I would be the only person there. You have a few, you know, members, as I would call them, El Codgers, knocking about. But, you know, I was left alone. And that's what I had. You know, I could, in Portmarnock, you could hit 3 or 4 balls and, you know, out even on the golf course. And there's so many different shots that I learned through, you know, just experiments more than anything else.
I
know exactly what you're saying, but sometimes people forget that they have to learn for, you know, it's more experimental learning than anything.
Yes.
As I would always say, how do you teach a child to chip? You put a bunker in their way and go, right, get that ball over the bunker. And eventually they'll figure it out, and that's the way they're going to do it. It'll take a little bit longer, you know, than you would if you tried to teach them, but eventually they'll teach themselves how to play the shot, and then you try and work on what they've learned themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, experimentation is always very good in golf.
Yes, it's very absorbing, it's very enjoyable, very rewarding. Right, fellas, we have to wrap this up. We all have homes to go to. Oh wait.
Yes. Well,
no, we've got dinner to make.
I have a dinner to make.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that is Golf Weekly for this week. My thanks to Fionn Davenport and Peter Lawrie. Thanks, fellas.
Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.